is the 7th of March with Dr. Stephen Holt, and I am the facilitator for this wonderful process. Appreciate your presence, and I believe there is a sign-in sheet right there at the edge of the table. If you want to participate in public testimony, we'd ask that you sign up and capture your email address so that a couple of things. One is so we can have correspondence and you can stay in the loop of everything that's going on, but we also want to get your name for today. So we're going to officially get rolling and do a little roll call around, and then I'm going to ask Jennifer to kind of introduce us to who is soon to be coming, but isn't here yet, and then we'll go on with our agenda for the day. So roll call.
Susan Emmons, Bond Oversight Committee member.
Todd Struble, Bond Oversight Committee member. And I mentioned to the facilitator that I will have to leave at 10:15.
Good morning, I'm Alan Lazlo with the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. I'm a Bond Oversight Committee member.
And then those around the table this morning.
Stacey Jeffries with the Housing Bureau.
Good morning, Jennifer Chang with the Housing Bureau.
Good morning, Molly Rogers with the Housing Bureau.
Good morning, Tanya Wolfersberger with the Housing Bureau.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thanks, everybody. I'm not going to go over our kind of talking points in terms of how we do what we do, other than to say I appreciate the fact that when we have concern, question, or want to comment, we continue to put our name cards on its edge and then wait until you're acknowledged. Thank you so much. To those who are in the room, this is a meeting that is open to the public. It is not a public meeting. So what that means is you have the opportunity to sit in, listen, and oversee, or I should say, hear what the Oversight Committee is working on. You're exposed to the information. This is information about what the is on the agenda, and we follow that agenda. And at the point of public testimony, should you have concern or thought or issues pertaining to the agenda, we encourage you to interact. However, if something is on your mind or your heart or your concern that is not pertaining to the agenda, I'd ask you to wait until after the meeting, and then in a polite, kind, and gentle way, interact with the staff of the Portland Housing Bureau. Portland Housing Bureau staff, would you acknowledge yourself by raising your hands, please? So if you look around the room, you can see all of those who are PHB staff. You can grab one of them after the meeting. Jennifer, would you like to tell us a little bit about our soon-to-be?
Well, we're really excited to introduce Annalise Kohler from the Oregon Food Bank, and she oversees housing policy. And so she will be appointed soon. She's our soon-to-be-newly appointed member of the Oversight Committee, appointed through by Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. And so we're currently working to confirm an actual official city council date for her formal appointment, but we're hoping that will occur prior to our next BOC meeting, probably early April or late March. And at that time, you know, she'll be at the table. So we're excited to have her, and yeah.
Thank you very much, and welcome. Glad you're here. Kind of see how things go and how we do what we do. So it's exciting. She is replacing Jess Larson, who had to step down because of her assignments with Metro. All right. We will get rolling. Again, we're going to follow along our agenda. So progress updates from Tanya.
Do you want to do the meetings first?
Sure. Do we need to? Absolutely. Absolutely. I skipped right over that.
And that's right.
Yeah. Any meeting summary?
I reviewed it, and it looked accurate to me. I move that we adopt the meeting summary.
Second.
Mike.
Excellent. Excellent. Nice. Seconded and agreed upon 100%.
Done.
Very good.
Y'all are so efficient. All right, now that we've taken care of that, we're going to start with some progress updates. We have, we're going to skip through a couple slides and come back to those when Shannon is able to join us. So just excuse me while I skip ahead real quick. So we just want to start off with, again, a review of all of the bond identified projects. You've seen this before. There is a new addition to this list. As you all know, on February 22nd, we convened the Property Review Committee to vote to approve the addition of the Joyce Hotel as a bond identified project, and we'll talk about that. The proposed development plans for that project a little bit later. So also just want to emphasize that the approximate numbers that you see in terms of unit counts are just approximations, with the exception of the Joyce Hotel, which would be a rehab, envisioned as a rehab project with the same amount of units. So there are several factors that will influence the final unit count on all of these approximate units that you see up on the board today. So just want to make sure that that is clear for everyone. And then again, our lovely map, just to show you kind of where these projects reside within the city of Portland. So you can see kind of how they're spread out currently. And then just want to kind of tee up kind of what brings us together today for this special convening of the Bond Oversight Committee is to talk about the change in our operational thought process and model going forward, which was the passage of Measure 102 back in November, which amended our state constitution to allow a different kind of ownership structure using general obligation bonds. So we went from being 100% publicly owned requirements to having some options, which are great, that we can leverage bond funds to third-party entities, privately owned buildings, and publicly owned land. So that's what we'll be talking about today, is our process and our thoughts and proposals about how we're going to go about leveraging private financing sources with the bond going forward to meet our goals. And I will hand it over to Molly to go through that more detail.
Thank you, everyone. Good morning. I'm hoping to address some of the outstanding factors that we were deliberating on last month as we further refine and better understand the framework and how we're going to move towards implementation of the bond. There are various things that we're going to need to meet and achieve, and there are ways that we do solicitations that over the years that we will, of course, keep going and doing, so we're not reinventing the wheel, but there are certain components of the bonds that are a little bit different. So we're having to do some things a little bit differently. There's very aggressive 30% goals. We have set ourselves PSH goals, permanent supportive housing goals, and we're having to really ensure that we work in partnership with the development community to achieve all those goals. So we're kind of fascinating in this sort of point in time is we're able to also build upon all the excellent work in the last 2 years of having some properties that we acquired under the different approach, and we're now able to move forward in a very different way and leverage additional resources to actually move those projects forward. So I'm happy to kind of go through a little bit of our thinking of some of those factors that we were still deliberating on. And just to be clear, this is very dynamic. A lot of work has happened, but there's still more work to be done. Our hope is to be able to release a bond opportunity solicitation at the end of April. So this is what you're getting is our latest thinking. So we really very much interested in your input in this, in some of our recent thinking, so we can help refine and get it right before the end of April. So just a reminder of what we talked about last month. We would like to continue this idea of pursuing both releasing city-owned properties, but also allowing sponsors to come in for sites that they have under their control. So we are able to really make sure, say, properties that are sitting vacant right now, we can move forward as quickly as possible with partners that are used to leveraging private resources. But also, the last couple of years, there are also sites that are, let's say, outside of your RAE districts that are able to move forward quickly as well with using the bond money. We're thinking right now about releasing between $50 million and $75 million. $75 million represents about half of the bond money we have left. We recognize that that's incredible amount of work that goes into that level of funding, but it's really exciting because we want to be able to get as many projects on the ground as possible. We're shifting our thinking around our estimated unit range. I'm hoping we can do a little bit of a stretch goal, getting up to maybe up to 600, but there are a lot of factors go into that. Obviously, depending on what kind of bedroom sizes, what kind of pricing people get, interest rates, there's all kinds of different things that go into and what actual sites that we don't even really know about that might come in. So we are trying to be flexible and responsive to what partners may come in with. We want to be open to both new construction and acquisition rehab. We're gonna talk a little bit about this in a little bit around there's a different level of subsidy we think different approaches will require. And so we need to be cognizant of how we reach our overall goals and how much we're able to do in new construction versus acquisition rehab. We want to be flexible and allow both construction types. There's pros and cons to both. There are public benefits in either way. So for this solicitation, we are not trying to be too prescriptive around how much we will do for either category, but a year from now, depending on where we are in terms of the overall goals, we may need to be more prescriptive around this. Did you have a question, Todd?
I wanted to ask about the per unit benefit of doing this. I mean, I think we had target ranges of, if I remember, it's like $180,000 to $200,000 per unit of housing to reach our goals. If we're on the lower end of these targets, that doesn't seem like, I just did some quick math, it seems like definitely a benefit, but I guess what's the target price per unit that we're aiming for by taking this approach?
Yes, actually we're gonna get into a big discussion on that in just a few slides. You are right on top of it. But there are there's a lot to unpack around coming up with an actual subsidy limit. And just to be clear, right now our hope is we want to, of course, we need to meet all of our various goals and we would like to exceed those goals, but we're not putting ourselves in a position of trying to come up with an exact number around that. But there is a method, there is some incredible thinking that the staff has done around coming up with some ideas around subsidy limits. But we want to overall exceed the goals if we can. In terms of location priorities, we haven't shifted our thinking around this since last month, but this is just a map that shows in conjunction with where our currently invested projects will be. So if you look at, North Portland, we don't have any bond funded projects as yet. Southwest Portland also, and then if you look at East County, we've got one property, 105th and Burnside right now, but we're hoping to do some further investment in East County, East Portland as well. So our proposal, our thinking at this moment in time is to release three city-owned sites this spring. Those three would be the West Wind. Right now, that is being managed by Central City Concern. And we also have hired relocation specialists to work with the current residents in finding new homes and also ensuring that they are getting the full benefit of the Uniform Relocation Act. So that is whole, and then after all the residents are relocated, that property will actually be demolished and we will find a development partner to come up with a replacement of a whole new building. Our hope is a minimum of 70 units and a minimum of 70 permanent supportive housing units in its replacement.
Yes, Susan?
I just had a brief question, and this doesn't have to be answered today, but I was thinking after our last meeting about the relocation of the residents of the West Wind, and I was wondering if at some point we could get a report on who has been contracted to do it, where are they looking for people, and will there be follow-up? Because my experience in the past at Northwest Pilot Project, and this is just an example, we didn't do the relocation of the people from the Hamilton and the Lonsdale in 1993 when the federal government decided to do a new courthouse. That was contracted out. And when Recovery Inn, the shelter, closed in 1995, we convinced the county and the city to do a formal relocation. And it was shocking the number of people in that shelter who lived at the Hamilton and the Lonsdale, who'd been relocated, been given the adequate amount of money. So I think the concern is it a permanent relocation, and are the contracted people going to follow them and report back in 6 months and a year and say those people were permanently, they found something that was affordable for them over the long haul? It doesn't have to be answered today, but it's just a concern.
Yeah, we can report back at our next meeting on progress. Right now, we do have Overland Pacific and Cutler, I think is what they just go by, OPC currently. Mm-hmm. We have a contract with them. We're in the process of amending our contract so they can manage the benefit payouts on our behalf as well. But they have, where they've gotten to date is they have had initial interviews with all of the tenants of the West Wind. That is to inform them on the next step would be to write up and send out notices of eligibility to each resident, which really describes what their benefit levels will be under URA. And then they will start working with each client individually to find housing for them. Their typical approach would be to offer each person at least three options that they could choose from with housing that would meet with them. And then if they request it, they will go with them personally to fill out applications, find missing documents, whatever it takes to get them, help assist them with that new housing and relocation. But again, by our next Oversight Committee meeting in April, we should have a little bit more detail on their progress.
Yes, it's a big endeavor.
We'd like to release the choice as part of the solicitation. Right now it is sitting vacant, and we have to think about the securing of that property every day, because sometimes there are things that happen in around that community that we have to address. But right now we know we're envisioning a rehabilitation of the 69 SRO, and our hope is that it would be 69 permanent supportive housing units in its place. We're also, we have purchased a site in the Colley neighborhood in Northeast Prescott. Our initial modeling is showing it could be about 50 family-sized units at that property. In addition, we're hoping to allow 3 to 5 other projects to be funded through this solicitation. Through that, as I mentioned before, we're talking about kind of a wide range of unit goals. But within that range, we're hoping at least half to meet our goals will be family-sized units, and then about a third will meet our 30% AMI restricted requirement goals as well. In terms of our programmatic requirements, just like every one of our projects, we want units to be restricted to at least 60% of area median income below. And then within how do we meet our 30% AMI goals, is this approach of we're having a minimum of 200% PSH and 100% 30% restricted building. So those would be fully subsidized with project-based vouchers. We're hoping then to achieve our other goals, 30% goals, through a 30 to 35% of the other projects having that as a of those total units would be restricted at 30% below. We are going to talk a little bit next about a maximum subsidy per limit. And then we are also going to be, of course, using PHB's DMWBSB goals that are incrementally getting up to 30% by 2021 at a 2% increase each year. And then for 20% of those goals for soft costs. And we'll be also looking to
look at development partners that have experience with aligning services, and we're working quite a bit with the joint office of how do we really ensure the services are there on an ongoing basis. Yes, Alan.
So can you go, I guess the top two bullets here, they're not mutually exclusive, right? So it says all units are regulated at 60% of AMI or below, and then the 30% AMI goals, and so I think I just missed a step there. It says minimum two 100% PSH buildings. So that's 100% 0 to 30 PSH, which is traditionally what we would see, right?
PSH and 30% below.
And then it says all others 30 to 35. So does that mean that essentially that top bullet means all units can be regulated in this case at below 35%? Or there can be some that are going to be between that 35 and 60. So that sounds like this encompasses all of the units in that second bullet.
So what we're intending is to, what we're showing is that of the non-100% PSH or 30% buildings, we will expect about a third, 30 to 35% of those units to be restricted at 30% and below. And the remaining, I guess that would be then 65 to 70% of those units would be restricted to 60%
AMI. Okay, sorry, I was confused.
It's all the, it's the sub-goals.
That's percentage of units, which is what it actually says there.
It's not AMI.
Yeah.
All right, there we go.
It's a lot of percent.
It's a lot of percent.
All right.
Just to be super clear, that does not mean like other buildings will include 30 to 35% of PSH units. That's like a separate.
That's a separate.
Are there targets for a certain number of PSH units in other buildings?
Yes. So we're having conversations with the joint office to better understand their level of service commitments they can bring, but we would like to see, in addition to. We're going to talk a year from now. We're hoping to have another 100% PSH and 30% restricted property. In addition, we will be looking to see if we can do a minimum of 5% of PSH across all the properties. But we're still in conversations with the joint office around that.
Todd, and also in the previous meeting's agenda, or the previous meeting, if you have your binder. There was also a presentation more directly about how we plan to intersperse those supportive housing units. So there would be an additional 29 being programmed in the family arena. Oh, I'm sorry. No, we have 29 complete. There would be 31 for dedicated to families. If I may interject and just say hello, my deep apologies for being late. I had a meeting with the mayor this morning regarding our budget, and so which is very timely as we're presenting our budget to council next week. So my deep apologies. If it wasn't with my boss, I would have done everything I could to be here on time.
So that really one of the biggest things that we're Tanya, please do. Sorry. Moving forward. This is a new approach for us. We are really looking at a concept of a subsidy limit because for many, many reasons. One, we need to absolutely ensure that we will meet all of the bond goals, which means we can't, we can't just 100% fund every project and any kind of, without in any amount that they would request. So we have to really think about being really strategic and about our resources, and also how do we leverage as much as the private resources as much as possible. That being said, we are hoping to have limits that will allow a sponsor to not have to secure other competitive public gap sources. Mm-hmm. The idea is that these limits are high, they're actually higher than our historic actuals, mm-hmm. because we want to ensure that we have enough subsidy to meet our 30% unsubsidized goals and to allow for the sponsors to move quickly with the non-competitive 4% tax credit application and secure private debt. So ultimately, we'll have three financing sources, which is generally less than what a typical project comes in with. It would be the bond funds, 4% tax credits, and a private mortgage. The idea is that we want to move as quickly as possible getting units built. So this is, so in the past, we've had goals. We've set goals in terms of how much we want to subsidize in our housing, but sometimes it's, you know, 2 to 3 years prior to those projects getting built, and the numbers change. And often we're in a position of having to come back and work with that sponsor, and the gap shifts. Well, we don't, we need to be responsive to the taxpayers who voted in this measure to ensure that we are really truly going to meet these goals. So we're trying to be proactive and responsive to what we're asking the sponsors to do, and to adhere to a subsidy limit. So we're talking about $150,000 for new construction, which, as you know, Todd was already indicating, is sort of lower than what we have funds for, but also it's, but in actuality, it's higher than what our actual last current projects have been funded at. So we went back in time and we looked at 6 active projects right now and how much, and looked at all the various market conditions around pricing and interest rates and so forth, and we controlled for that, and we looked at the additional expectations we will want for to achieve our affordability goals, and we are and we looked at other public sources that those sponsors have brought in, and we think we can make it with the $150,000 per unit.
Molly, may I just clarify, that's not the expectation that each bidder will receive that amount per unit. That is an absolute max cap. Yep. So we are, and although we are not requiring that they bring a number of other non-competitive matching funds, we're not precluding that either. But we want to make sure that we are providing an avenue that allows projects to come to us and proceed on a rapid timeline. But our, you know, I want to make it clear that our expectation is not that each building will receive 150. I mean, if proposals come in with that exact amount, I mean, that there's much more detail behind it. We check all performance, and we'll be doing that throughout the scoring process. So just, yeah, that is literally the outer limits of what we would subsidize at all.
Yep, that's a really good point. Yeah, absolutely. This does not mean every project should come in at these limits, obviously. There's a whole feasibility analysis, and there's also a whole, there are very, 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 very many variables that come in that ultimately determine the subsidy. We want to create a little bit of some sort of predictability here, but yes, that will be part of the underwriting process. Is we're hoping actually they'll come in at less than this. And then, of course, in acquisition rehab, hopefully they'll come in even less than $100,000. But we know we can achieve these goals with these if these limits. If, say, someone wants to have a very complex project coming in, and then
last question.
Yes.
So, like Todd pointed out, these are lower than the original modeling showed. So, do you know, or does Carl know, where we are now on units? I mean, I'm assuming it has a positive impact on goals. And that being said, do we have a stretch goal? Mm-hmm.
Shannon, do you want to take that one on?
I can take that question if you want.
I'm going to answer the latter part of your question regarding stretch goal. I think, you know, one of the things we've been really cautious about is setting a new target for the housing bond. I will tell you that we really are planning to exceed that goal, and can these numbers will allow us to do that as well. But we also want to be clear about potentially setting a target that then is now reported as a new goal for the bond. And frankly, when you look at setting goals, each of these pieces of the underlying goals regarding 0 to 30 and PSH and family size would also likely need to be reanalyzed. We feel like it would be kind of reopening a framework, but we are hoping to achieve hundreds more units than this, but I don't want to set a precise target. but yes, we're hoping to stretch beyond that without a particular number. I hope you're comfortable with that. You know, if there's more information you'd like us to provide you as we're going through the RFP process and our first solicitation, I think our first solicitation will help us to determine where we are going, and what we see and what is funded after that as to what potential goals we can reach for the second solicitation. But we've been pretty cautious to not talk about a new actual numeric target unless you are really desiring us to go down that route.
So hypothetically, if there was a nonprofit who had site control and they had a design all set up, and possibly they'd been blocked by a neighborhood group and they're going to Luber or whatever.
Goodness, yeah.
But they feel they're going to be successful. They don't have all their financing together. If they had a project where they only were going to have so many units at the goal of the bond, could they apply for just gap funding or for those units? Or it doesn't work that way. You have to have the whole project.
So a sponsor could, of course, have a larger project and only ask for subsidy from us for a certain portion of those units. I don't think that there's anything that would preclude that. So for instance, say you had a 100-unit building and you were only applying, is this your question, if you want support for 30 of those units through the bond?
Yeah.
So there would be nothing that would preclude that. There are other complicating factors regarding that in terms of how we structure regulatory agreements, where the other funding is coming in, but there's nothing to preclude that. I think one of the issues that will be there for any provider that has a building developed that won't meet the underlying goals of the housing bond and what we're putting out will be could be a concern. So
yeah.
Obviously we'll be really seeking, besides our PSH goals, to reach all the other goals. And we heavily lean toward family size units. And so that's going to be one of the factors if, for instance, a building of this type had a number of smaller units. It may cause some difficulties in how they would adapt to this. Not to say we're talking about a particular project. But.
And then the other thing in thinking about this that may just disqualify them is geographical location, because we're really trying for certain geography. Like if we already have projects and we're not meeting a goal in other geographical areas, would that possibly disqualify?
We're definitely looking at geography as a preference, not a 100% floor. So it wouldn't preclude them, but they wouldn't get a preference for that. But if this hypothetical project say that we're going to obviously advance our like I say PSH goals, that would be something to consider as well.
And during the scoring and evaluation process, which we haven't really talked to you about, we. I think can talk to you a little bit more about that in April, and then obviously we want you as members to participate in that that process. But you know, there's a lot of weighing of different factors that go in. So no building actually ever comes in that's an apples to apples comparison. It's very, you know, it's not like you're saying, oh, this ideal building in East Portland is exactly like this building. There are so many factors that go into it. It's a you know, it's a process that there's a lot of weighing, but. You know, all things being equal, if we had that exact same building in one of our priority locations, I would imagine, you know, that's what we're talking about for our preference. But you know, there are going to be challenges for our proposers to come in. These are, you know, we don't have these elaborate goals on the number of family size units, et cetera. In terms of overall programming. Our URAs, for instance, have not had those goals necessarily set. We do try to always achieve that, but we have some very rigid targets. And so that will be a challenge for our proposers. But I hope that answered your question.
Yeah.
I have a related question to Carly.
Yeah, go ahead. No, I don't know, Alan, you're looking at me like you wanted.
I don't want you to walk up all the way up here for nothing, Carly.
I think the answers that Shannon and Molly provided were good. But if you need more information, please ask.
Maybe you had something specific.
No.
I understand.
I have a little bit of a follow-up question that's sort of related. I guess, is site control going to be like a requirement for some of this? Or I guess,
for as it comes as a subsidy, it's like here's already a proposal. But what if, I mean, there's what if a nonprofit is like looking at a site that's on the market? Can they propose? I mean, I guess how will the is acquisition part, like land acquisition, yeah, part of the strategy anymore at this point?
So land acquisition by itself is not. Typically, we require in our solicitations a 6 months to some kind of land, some kind of security in the land, you know, whether that's an option, whether it's actual fee simple purchase, whether it's a lease. But the usual is needs to be 6 months by the time from the award time.
And just to be clear, that's for the half of the remaining bond dollars. So is there, I guess the remaining bond dollars that are not part of the solicitation process, that's still available for site acquisition or?
No. So
no more site acquisition.
So go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, so I think, I think what we're trying to talk about is, Carl uses the term, I think, land banking. That to us would mean that we are taking and holding raw land for a period of time. What you could do is secure raw land with the development funds from us, right? So you could come to us and say, I have an option on this particular parcel, and I will buy this parcel, and I will develop this building. And we are coming and applying to you for those funds. So that is definitely allowed and contemplated with the bond. We are also would allow someone to come in. This is all in kind of how we generally work. Someone could also bring us an existing building with tenants in the building, a market rate building, and say we want to acquire this and preserve, make this a long-term affordable asset. We have not been thinking about, at the present moment, the Housing Bureau continuing to buy land for future development at this moment in time. But I do think that's something we want to talk with you about after we get through solicitation number one, is what did we see? What did we get back? What do we still want to achieve? Maybe there's some reason for us or our partners to go out and secure sites to make sure that we're reaching some additional location priority. So we're not foreclosing the buying new acquisitions, but for right now, we're trying to focus on at least the first of the two solicitations. And I think our thinking may really dramatically change potentially after we all see what the results in solicitation number one. And so there are opportunities, I think, for us to have discussions about further raw site acquisition.
Any more questions around subsidy limits? Okay, next slide, we're gonna talk a little bit about voucher deployment. So what we are proposing is to fully subsidize with a project-based rent assistance voucher the 100% PSH buildings. So the idea is that with permanent supportive housing, people who are chronically homeless, who may or may not have income, can still have access to that housing. So with a voucher, they can come in with zero income and still pay and have that unit be fully subsidized. So we're dedicating the 300 of our 400 to meet our PSH goals. That means we have a remaining 100 vouchers that we would like to, of course, help advance our 30% goals. It does, so that's, just to remind everyone, because these are numbers that we have all of in our heads all the time. But to as a refresher, we still have the goal of 600 units at 30% AMI, but we have 400 vouchers. So what happens is that we have 200 units that will need to meet a 30% AMI restriction without any voucher or any subsidy. That subsidy, actually, that those units will be financed as a subset of a larger property. So the 60% units will cross-subsidize the 30s. But we want to have flexibility right now because we don't really know what's going to come in, and every project has slightly different needs around financing. We're asking right now some flexibility to deploy those remaining 100 vouchers in the non 100% PSH buildings. By population, by project, to help us achieve our goals, depending on what comes in.
We're assuming, though, that it will most likely be more in family, family-sized units, family households, that really, so we can help achieve our priority community, the communities we've laid out as priority communities, so communities of color and people experiencing homelessness. Any questions about that approach?
So just historically of experience, obviously you've had that experience at Home Forwarded before, but a building like the Morrison, it's by the stadium where they play soccer, and there's just a subset of units in that building that have these project-based vouchers. Otherwise, it's 40%, 60%. It's a mix in that building, right? Mm-hmm. So, but those 30 or 45 units out of the 145, that's a model of how it can work.
That's exactly what we're proposing.
Yeah,
and is doing that model.
It's been remarkably successful.
Yes, yeah. It has been.
Yeah. Okay.
And then we're going to move on to Jennifer talking a little bit more about services alignment and the conversations we've been having at the Joint Office.
So we wanted to provide an update of our conversations with the Joint Office. So as you'll recall, the supportive housing goal in the bond is very dependent on funding sources for services that are not the bond funds. And so we've been partnering and coordinating very closely with the Joint Office to secure the services funding for the supportive housing units in the bond. Currently, we are using a $10,000 per household cost estimate for supportive services. So these are added funds that will come to support the households in the supportive housing units. And that $10,000 is directly from our regional or our local report conducted by the Corporation for Supportive Housing that did an analysis around costs in existing supportive housing units locally as well as some national. We're also going to be focusing on supportive housing chronically homeless households. We talked about this at the last meeting, but it's based on our information and the point in time count as one of the fastest growing and highest need populations within our homeless population, which is chronically homeless individuals in need of housing as well as wraparound support services. We're using an estimated staff to participant ratio of 1-15. This means very supportive intensive care and access to that ratio. And then also just there'll be a range of supportive services to help maintain successful tenancy. So this includes costs for staffing of service providers, and then also resident costs, maybe services, stipends. And then what we're proposing now is that our services connected to this bond solicitation will be provided by Multnomah County Qualified Supportive Housing Providers. The Joint Office just recently went through a solicitation last winter and has a list of about 18 to 20 qualified providers. And so we're currently proposing and planning to utilize that list of support service providers. So. Any questions?
One question. So that commitment from the Joint Office, let's say you use the Joyce as an example, that'd be an ongoing subsidy that they'd have to commit to over time. They have to earmark that in their budget.
Yes. And we know, and these conversations have been really valuable because as a system, you know, in addition to just the housing bond, the city and the county are committing to a larger goal around supportive housing, you know, 2,000 units. And as a system, there's a lot of developing and growth that we're needing to build, you know, in terms of funding support services over time.
This is a calling this now the Allen chart because he's watching these very closely.
I have another, an even further deep dive down on it. So.
Oh, right. See if we can do it. As you can see in this chart, there's very wide ranges because we are setting goals and we're hoping to fund a lot of projects, but we don't exactly know how many that will come out. And obviously next year, everything will be much more dialed in. But we will see, we're getting closer to our 75% mark at the end of this, at the end, as with if we meet all the goals that we've set out for the solicitation. These goals do include the projects that we've already completed. And it does include what we're conceiving on 30th and Powell, which Shannon will talk about in just a few minutes. But we will. But overall, you can see that we are on target with total units and our 30% AMI units, assuming we do the two PSH 100% buildings. And it also means we are exceeding our goals in family size units. So this is where a year from now, when we do this all over again, we will have to be thinking about those different targets a little bit differently to get to 100% everywhere. Mm-hmm. But it does. This keeps us keeping an eye on the prize and where we're going to meet all the various needs that we've set out for ourselves. It's exciting.
Yeah.
Anything you want to mention?
I really appreciate you taking that feedback and adding the dollars to, because it does give us a picture of where we are. And when we go to questions about the solicitation, I'll ask about location and dollars. The one thing, because I think it's great, and I think the one thing that is also helpful is what you did with 30th and Powell, where you actually showed that where that $27 million is actually for that, is that project. Because I think you could almost do it with the other units. There is some detail there that would tell us, you know, how you arrived at each of those numbers. And that may be too much for this chart, but you might also be able to do it on the website so people could click through and see, mm-hmm. essentially showing your work for the math that's being done and being a little more transparent, and being even more transparent than we are right now, because I don't know if anybody else has those same questions, but it's the way I answer questions for myself. And because I'm assuming these numbers, because they tie back to the bond solicitation, the 50 to 75 million are directly related to the bond, and so are the total units. So there's an explanation for them that, again, if somebody in the public wanted to see them, it'd be easy to tie it to this chart. I think I shouldn't say that. It could be tied to this chart. I'm assuming it's not easy for all of you folks to have to do that, because everybody's got plenty on their plate. But
I actually think that's something that I think that's feedback we can take. I think that's feedback that we can take easily take in, especially when it comes to what's already completed, where those are with a little clickable. I mean, it should not be difficult for us. It may take us a little bit of time, but I think that's a really helpful suggestion.
Thanks. Yeah, because it is just the way I think about it, and for me, and I think it's helpful. So appreciate that.
How's it all tracking down in the same? Yeah, Carl's team has done a fabulous job of ensuring this is all lined up.
Absolutely.
So just to recap, our proposed timeline, or our planned timeline for this solicitation, is we're currently, since February through April, in the process of reaching out to several stakeholder groups and community groups regarding the plans for this solicitation and getting feedback. We plan to issue this solicitation in April, and then have a several months until the deadline, so a couple months, and then issue award letters in August. Just thinking a year ahead is when we'll look to our second solicitation, deeply informed, of course, by the results from the first. And in terms of outreach, thank you. So this is updated from our last month with more detailed dates. Next week, actually, we'll be meeting with Housing Oregon members and other housing developers to review proposed plans and get their feedback. And then the 21st, we will be conducting outreach with contractors, subcontractors, and potential workforce development partners.
And then the following week, we'll be meeting with supportive housing providers. We're co-hosting that meeting with the joint office and also reviewing the solicitation, getting their feedback around services and, you know, how, what can be included. And then finally, April 4th is our community meeting at the Bond Oversight Committee at ERCO. And, excuse me, we'll be inviting several of our stakeholder groups that we engaged and worked with when we were developing the bond framework. And that includes MACG, OPAL, and our community engagement liaisons. And our general focus for these meetings is to give them an update on what has been occurring with the bond over the last couple years, and then just prepare them in knowing what our proposed plans are, our plans of releasing the solicitation and getting their feedback regarding that.
At our last meeting, we talked about the annual report to City Council.
Yes.
Is that coming up? Are you going to talk? I just wondered if it was March 27th, because I wanted to at least be in the
yes.
audience.
Yes, yes.
I realized I made another appointment. I kind of spaced it out. I don't.
Okay. So we are 99% of the way to completing the final report, probably by this week. We are still working with the Mayor's Office and City Council to solidify a time certain. We're also planning to pair that together with the appointment of Annalise. So we're hoping at the beginning of April currently. We're just waiting for confirmation for that. So as soon as we have that date, I'll be sending information out to all of you.
So we don't need to worry about March 27th?
Correct.
Okay. Sorry. I came with a list of questions today. So I've been thinking about these projects as they get developed, and I wondered if there was a plan of how you inform social service agencies who wish to refer their clients to bond properties about each property. And you know, that would include like the projected opening date, the number of appointments, unit sizes, rents, who's the management company, how do they refer? I think it would be good if there was some sort of global plan. I mean, they're just, you had your kind of designated referral list on Ellington, but I mean, beyond that, there are other providers. It just seems like it would be good to have a way of notifying these housing specialists who are desperately looking for units for.
With the first two bond properties, kept to a list that we talked with you all about mm-hmm. who should be on that to make sure that we were reaching our priority communities.
Right.
And so I think as we're looking at this with a lens that we won't be the owner of the buildings anymore, but we'll be talking with our sponsors about their marketing plans specifically. And I think there's some question about whether you do a broader, you know, I mean, there are access issues with all of these units, and how do you prioritize based on the building and who has access? And we have thus far been trying to make sure that we're using culturally specific providers, not exclusively, but making sure that they're included. But I think we also have questions about is this working for them in the way we've done the referral, so that are they prepared as they can be to actually get clients in. Certain agencies are frankly just speedier. It's more easy for them to access kind of a client list, and they have a wait list as opposed to some other agencies. So I think those are conversations we want to continue to have as well. And I think they're also going to be very building specific as to what the population and priority goals are, is my thinking. I think Jennifer has done some deep work on that as well.
I think definitely. I mean, our focus has been with the first two properties around culturally specific partners as well as homeless service family partners, because those have been the focus of the two buildings as we have looked to marketing and lease up. And we have worked with Home Forward around understanding the demographics of kind of, now that we have tenants in the homes, you know, understanding how is that referral process going and to what extent is it actually achieving our intended outcomes. And
we will definitely bring that back to you as we are collecting more information. And that's part of what we're reaching out to the community engagement liaisons in advance of our April 4th meeting, is to also get some feedback from them regarding have they been hearing about these through the organizations that we actually provided advance notification to, and what are those key places where they go for information around housing. And so that's something we will plan to bring to the following meeting. But I think to your point around a very intentional plan of reaching providers is something that we can include in the solicitation around asking proposers what their plan is and how they will reach and market to priority communities, including service providers.
So, you know, to your point, Shannon, of building specifically, that does make sense to me, that as you think about the joys and permanent supportive mm-hmm. housing and the type that's different than a family, yeah. it's not going to be a family building because of the size of the unit. So at 105th and Burnside, just generally, did that work out with the referring? I mean, did you work with culturally specific and found that you got referrals and the building presumably filled up? And
I mean,
we just got a more detailed information about all of the kind of recent demographic updates, and we can bring that to our April meeting. We haven't had time to really comb through it. I think I recall there were a handful of referrals that we could initially pinpoint, identify coming from culturally specific organizations, but we need to dig deeper in there and really kind of solidify those numbers to see exactly what happened during that process.
Alan? Susan's still looking at her list. I'm not sure if she's
going to cross
them all off. Sure? Okay. Actually, I want to follow up that question about, so I think it will be interesting when you look at the lease-ups on those, and if the culturally specific outreach, the affirmative marketing is working. Conversely, I think it would be interesting to look at if it's not working, are there barriers in place that we might need to consider as we move forward in the project? So that just came up as... Mm-hmm. So thanks for that question, Susan. So I want to go back to, there's three or four things that I wanted to touch on. One is, Jennifer, I was going to ask you specifically about the April 4th meeting and bringing the stakeholders back in. So it's great that's already happening, so I appreciate that. That's good. And you might extend it to the rest of the folks that were around that table, because I think that's a good point in the community to have those folks back. So I have a question about, so on the bond solicitation, is there explicit preference for location and geography in the solicitation itself, or do we want to, or do we not want to do that? I mean, it feels like we're going to be pretty intentional about that. So I just didn't know in the solicitation itself if that was something that was going to be in there, or if, obviously it'll be a factor that you and we will be considering, but will it be explicit in the solicitation?
So that is part of the... a lot of the outreach as well. We're going to be very clear, these are the priority locations. We're calling them priority and preferences because we'll see what comes in, but then we will apply that preference, and we'll be upfront about that.
And then, so along those lines, and this maybe jumps ahead kind of to when we get to the year two after the solicitation, we've got to see what comes in. But one of the things we've recognized, actually there's two points to this. One of the things that we've recognized is the difficulty in finding sites in North and Northeast, really, when we carve it out, because of the increased land prices up there. And so I think at some point, and that's part of, I think, where having the dollars on here helps, and we might have to have a discussion or make some decisions about, are we willing to pay more to attain that geographic priority? You know, and so we're gonna have to see what comes in, but I think that's a conversation that we're gonna have to put a pin in and have to have it at some point if things don't go that way.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Alan. I think Shannon's earlier point about preserving the option of securing sites, you know, that might be a way to do that, right? Is it rather than leaving the market, so to speak, to do that for us, even with the preferences that would be in the solicitation. That we may have to, you know, actually somehow secure a site, whether it's PHP securing it completely or whether it's sort of, you know, temporarily holding it for one of our partners or, you know, something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
And if I may just comment, I think one of the reasons we want to be really explicit about talking about these priorities, if we're all in agreement, is making sure that we're signaling to the development community where to try to get options on land. Because, I mean, one of the things they hear from us is, you know, what are those areas that you're wanting us to go in? Because they're, if anyone is following this, and we're meeting with a developer panel next week, trying to really have clear conversations so they can understand secure land here now if you want to do new development, so that I have a feeling that there are people actively seeking, well, I know there are actual people actually seeking parcels with these location priorities in mind. So hopefully that will bear fruit for us during the solicitation process.
Yeah, and so something else to think about too is that the capital that the Bureau has control over, it may be, you know, significant relative to our partners, and that there may be sort of some challenges around their ability to secure because they don't have access to capital or have or more limited access to capital. Yeah.
So yeah. They could come ask us. Be easier for them. Okay. So along the same lines with the location priorities, I think it might be interesting, I'm not actually sure how to accomplish this, for us to look at the location priorities overlaid with the other kind of framework priorities. And so one would be, for instance, communities of color. So if we lay that over geography, then we get a sense for whether or not we're serving the communities that we intended to serve. But the other side of it, because communities of color we wouldn't show as much in North and Northeast, but we'd also then want to overlay the other factors around high opportunity areas, right? So there's that mix, that tension around where we're investing and how we're investing to balance those priorities in the framework. And so so it's another piece that you know, I think folks in the framework know, but there may be a way to also convey that to the creative, you know, folks out there that we're going to rely on to help us seek out these projects, if it's not clear to them through the process. And, you know, I've been in the process the whole time, and it's not an easy thing to follow. So I don't know what else is out there.
I think that's a good reminder to us to just start reminding people of the requirements when we're doing these presentations of the opportunity scoring, because we did set minimum opportunity scores that we were trying to achieve for new developments. I think it was I believe it's a 3. So, which is a particular mapping program we have behind the scenes, but that may be a good thing because we intrinsically know this. Right. The five of us on this side of the table who have been working on this so diligently, but sometimes we need to refresh people's memory about our priorities, so I think that's a good one to put on the forefront.
Yeah, and you may be able to provide that data somehow again. I'm not sure if that's easy. Mm-hmm. And then the last piece is just on the outreach activities. Was there a thought given to specific, because it's not listed here, specific outreach to MWESB, both hard and soft contractors, and it's not shown separately, and I don't know if that's a consideration.
Bobby Daniels, Capital Projects Manager.
Sorry, we couldn't hear.
Bobby Daniels, Capital Projects Manager.
That March 21st contractor, subcontractor, workforce outreach is actually a meet and greet with our development partners to kind of get them in front of our typically underserved certified groups that do the work. Then I think we talked about this last week or about a month ago or so. We also have a RFP that's going out to have a third-party technical assistance that'll help us garner those companies that we don't typically see on our projects.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, that's right. That's my list.
Thank you very much. Todd, we want to hear from you, especially since you indicated.
Yeah, Todd, I think this should be pretty quick. I just wanted to dovetail one of Alan's questions of the price of land, and maybe this is will be addressed in the solicitation process, but I think I would like to see the additional expense of like where things are happening as like a function of the entire project rather than just how much more the land costs, if that makes sense. So I guess, for example, you know, you have $1 million land value, but the end product will be like a $20 or $30 million project. That's a small fraction of the overall cost. So paying a small premium, or maybe even a significant premium, for the land value may not actually contribute a whole lot to the overall like project in a percentage-wise basis. So I guess I'm assuming that may be addressed in the solicitation process, but I just want to call that out as sometimes the land value itself ends up, like the cost of construction, everything else becomes such a bigger part of
it. I mean, the land factor for us is, you know, we expect our partners to pay what's reasonable in the market. It's not going to be really a barrier, I don't think, overall to the project. Frankly, the land cost is a small fraction of really the total development cost. And I'm sorry to try to move you on, but I know, Todd, you have to leave in 10 minutes. I think there's a couple of hot items that we really wanted to make sure we talk with you all about while we have you all present, if you don't mind. And they have to do with the solicitation and the proposed release of how we are proposing to release certain properties we already have control over at the Housing Bureau. So you're going back in time. So I think you've already looked at this slide. And as you know, on the right-hand side, these are the proposed projects that we are wanting to get your feedback on, because we would be intending to put those out in the first solicitation, with the exception of 30th and Powell. I'd like to have a larger discussion with you about 30th and Powell, but we wanted to get some initial feedback from you about putting out the West Wind, the Joyce, as well as Northeast Prescott in the solicitation. And I don't know if you have, should we consider not putting all of our assets out in the same solicitation? Do you have thoughts about that? We're proposing to use what we have and not to wait on the development opportunities that we have in hand. We also feel pretty strongly about our commitment to the supportive housing and being able to move those buildings as quickly as possible into housing folks that are frankly presently homeless, and providing them permanent housing. But I wanted to kind of highlight that for you. I think we're gonna have discussions about this also with our development partners. But our strategy is to deploy the assets that we have available in the housing bond in this solicitation while still providing opportunity for other development partners to go forward. And then I also wanted to talk with you about 30th and Powell and our plans for how we proceed with that.
Did you want, Shannon, did you want them to weigh in on the three that you've identified?
I just wanted to make sure that you understand that this is kind of what we're proposing and that we are asking for your feedback, whether it's at this meeting or whether you want to provide us feedback. We also may get feedback from the community about proposing to put all these properties out. I mean, I think the balance here is, do we want to give more latitude in this first solicitation for people to bring their own properties in? Is there a valid reason for us to say, wait on the Cully property for next year? Frankly, I heavily lean toward leveraging everything we've got in the first solicitation. And that's why I think the whole team does, and that's why we're proposing that. But I just wanted to make sure that this is on your kind of general radar as a
comment at all from any of the oversight committee members. Carl.
I don't see any problem with it. I mean, the idea of the Joyce is it's vacant. And so you'd be very specific in what you're asking. You'd be looking for someone to come in and do it for that population, permanent supportive housing. Mm-hmm. What would it take? It's a rehab. How quickly could they move? And see who comes forward.
Yeah, I think the upsides, they're already vetted against the priorities, right?
Right.
So you don't have to go through that process. The question is, order of magnitude wise, do you know how much of the solicitation those projects occupy versus the ones that might be able to come in on the 3 to 5
yes.
partner projects?
Yes.
Did you tell us that already, probably? Was that one of the percentages?
Well, yeah, I do not have the number off the top of my head, and I'd be afraid to noodle here in front of you, but it's on that computer behind me. I can get it.
That, I mean, that's obviously the
that yeah, will be right. Part of the solicitation is being clear of where we're looking in terms of that investment.
Right, and all of these that we're putting out would have the same subsidy limit.
Oh, right.
That any of the other, okay. The other, yeah. So yeah. that is how we're moving forward. So, all of the buildings, yeah, they'd all fall under the same rules and requirements. So with that, I'd like to talk about 30th and Powell a little bit. So as you know, we've been working on 30th and Powell for some time with our development partner, Home Forward, under the concept as an owner ourselves, as the city, that we needed a development assistance, and Home Forward has contracted for architecture services and other pre-development work as our partner. We were initially thinking, of course, we would have to fully fund 30th and Powell with 100% bond resources. The total build on that project would have been probably in the magnitude prior to the constitutional amendment of I'm sorry, Carl?
Total over 50 million.
Total, we would have had to expend is over $50 million. So clearly, I think what we're proposing total in the project now, because we would still apply the subsidy caps to this project, is $27 million. But we are at a situation where we are so far down the work in our partnership with Home Forward. This is not a property that we feel like we want to stop all work. We've expended resources, both jointly ourselves and Home Forward, to move this forward. So we would be proposing to actually move this project with Home Forward's agreement. They haven't completely assented. They need to know that, I mean, they would need to assent to this as well. But we'd be asking them to take that project on as a sponsor directly. So under the same terms and conditions that will exist under the solicitation, but that the Housing Bureau would not intend to own the building in the long term. We would lease the land and have Home Forward as a sponsor, just like any of the other projects. So I wanted to specifically call that out to you as a proposal, because we would not be intending to put it out for solicitation for another partner to come and bid on. We would lose both time and quite a bit of money with any other proposal. So that's our thought process.
Could you remind us what the mix is? Are those family units or, yeah?
Well, it's in the feasibility study process right now. So that's where we're in the process of honing in on what the unit mix and number of units are exactly. But we are still working towards meeting all of the framework goals. So working towards family size units. I think we are continue to have a goal to program the building with PSH that is for families. And so it's envisioned as a family project overall.
I would just like to say I'm supportive of sticking with Home Forward and not slowing it down, since you've done all this work with them.
Excellent. I'd like to hear from each of the community members.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I'd say the same thing, because with working with the assumption that Home Forward with them would just be adopting the agreement essentially that you already have in place that they are implementing, right? I mean, that's the way that's going to work. Yeah. Yeah, agreed.
Thank you.
I mean, I think politically, as you look at all these other, there's all this other resource, and there's lots of, you know, there's lots to go around, I hope, for other people who want to come forward.
Yeah, very definitely.
Any other comment from PHP staff? Any other information that we need to cover? Questions, comments from our Oversight Committee members? Yes, Susan.
Well, I'd just like to say, this isn't bond finance, but there's a building going up in South Waterfront that some of us advocated for years, and just going down there and seeing that building going up and knowing that there are going to be some 30%, and it's really just fills my heart with joy. And I know PHP staff, I know it's been hard. I know the universe changed and shifted in terms of financing for part of it, but I just want to applaud you all because I see it coming along. And I think we were at City Council, it was when Gretchen was still alive in 2015 when we got approval, and it looks like it's going to open this year. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you for your work.
Well, and Susan, I will, it is not a bond topic either, but we are actually planning another property in South Waterfront right now. OHSU has come to us and offered us the opportunity to co-develop a property. We would provide funding to a development sponsor partner. They would build a parking lot, and we would rim it with affordable housing. It would have beautiful views of the river. And we are putting an RFP out. OHSU is and will be actively participating in that process at the end of March. So it is a significant opportunity for us to even go further to reach our goals in South Waterfront. So I'm very excited about that as well.
That's great news. Good meeting. I don't know if anyone signed up for public testimony, but now would be the time, I believe, we've got to the space.
I'm going to take my leave. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Todd. Have an excellent day. Thank you. Come on up.
I was late, so I didn't sign up.
That's okay. We're going to give you 2 minutes. And if you would say your name, and then you can begin.
Yes, my name is Sarah Carolus. I'm involved with Interfaith Alliance on Poverty, and this comment is coming from one of our partner congregations. We believe that in the framework, one of the priority communities for folks that were homeless or at risk of homeless were people with disabilities. And we're wondering if there's any intent for use of bond funds to create housing units specifically for people that need wheelchair access. And also, how is that being communicated to the communities involved?
Excellent, thank you very much. Excellent question.
Do we want to have a response?
I defer to PHP. Do you want to respond?
I can respond to part of that. We sometimes use shorthand terms and without fully explaining them. So, for what we're really looking at for our permanent supportive housing goals is for a population that is what we call chronically homeless for people with disabling conditions. So it really is the population that is people who have had the longest time being houseless and really with long-term disabling conditions that has been challenging for them to find housing in that way. So when we talk about our PSH goals, we're really wanting to ensure that that population is being most served in that way. But do you want to talk about?
Yeah, but I'll also say from the physical standpoint, physical disabilities, that that all the units will be adaptable, and that will have a percentage of that will be accessible as well. So, you know, that's a key consideration for us. And what we've discovered through the years is that providing adaptable units is really adds almost no cost to units, and so that's just a makes sense thing to do.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Well, great meeting, everyone. Again, and for those who are here, if there are other concerns and thoughts, you have staff from Portland Housing Bureau who would be more than willing to answer or direct you to the answers that you can secure. Appreciate your being here today. Our next meeting is scheduled for April 4th, and that will be in the community at the ERCO building on Gleason and 124th. So we look forward to seeing you. It'll be an evening meeting. Hopefully you can make that. Have an incredible day, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
I really